¿Quieres mejor internet? Cox Internet de 300 megas tiene las velocidades rápidas y confiables que buscas. Perfecto para streaming y gaming y trabajar desde casa. Todo por solo $45 al mes cuando agregas Cox Mobile. Incluye equipo de Wi-Fi y garantía de precio de 2 años en tu plan. No esperes. Cámbiate hoy a Cox. Requiere Cox Mobile Gig Unlimited. Garantía de precio no incluye impuestos y cargos. Velocidad de datos móviles se reduce después de 20 gigas al mes.
Everybody, welcome to the show. Gideon, how's it going this week, man?
Going good, man. You know, we were chatting a little earlier, playing some Jedi Survivor, started Witcher 3 on Death March difficulty, so that's
and you're gonna do it this time, right?
I'm doing it, I'm committed, and I gotta play the DLC too. That's like the mission for playing.
Okay, settle in, because the main game is long, and then both of those DLCs are long as hell too. So you're probably going to burn your if you do it all at once. I think you're going to burn yourself out, but we'll see.
I believe it. Yeah, we'll see how long it takes me. Probably like 2 years.
Yeah, that's okay. Yeah. Neil, you've played The Witcher 3 and all the DLC, right?
Yes.
Nice.
Yeah. That shit is really good. Did you prefer Blood and Wine or Hearts of Stone?
I think they both have their strong points. Like Hearts of Stone, I think it has the stronger narrative.
Yeah.
But Blood and Wine is just so ambitious for a DLC. It's like,
yeah,
it's almost a game by itself.
Nice.
Yeah, like, you're right about that.
It's just because the base game of Witcher 3 is so long that, Blood and Wine is like a third of that.
Damn.
Now, have either of you touched Cyberpunk?
Only a couple hours, not
okay.
That
only a couple hours, okay. Because I really loved The Witcher 3, and like normally I really don't go in for like fantasy stuff that much, and I really don't go into for like side quests all that much. So when Witcher 3 was like, I did absolutely everything, mm-hmm. and maxed that game out and did all the side quests and read all the journal logs, like that, I think goes to show you the quality of that game. And then Cyberpunk was like not only a genre I was way more interested in, but I mean I've done everything in that game like 2 or 3 times. Like I've played the wheels off Cyberpunk. I think that game is awesome. Anyway, already heard from Neil. How's it going this week, man? Neil.
You said you already heard from me.
Oh yeah, how's it going this week?
Back to work, had a long weekend, which was nice, and immediately regretted coming back.
Mm-hmm. Coming back to work?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just I had a 3-day. Yeah, well, I had a 3-day weekend, and by the time, I'm always looking forward to the 3-day weekend, but by the end of that third day, I'm kind of ready to be back at work. But it sounds like that really wasn't the case for you.
No, we're just getting towards the end of the school year, and all the dumb questions that always get asked by not by students but by staff at the end of every school year just coming out. It's like, we've been over this. You've asked this question. I know it.
Yeah.
Like, why can't you remember this piece of information? Why are you bad at your job?
I'll tell you, man. So there's no computer problem that I mind helping with, but some of the ways people write tickets into our ticketing system really makes me laugh. I got a ticket that, like 2 mornings ago, with the subject line was "I cannot work like this" in all caps.
That's awesome.
Please send help. I was like, okay. Let's try to be a little bit more dramatic. She just needed her monitors moved. I was like,
oh my god.
Yeah, I was like, okay, whatever. Anyway, so we were set to have a guest star who was going to come on and talk about Pan's Labyrinth. So we all watched Pan's Labyrinth in anticipation of her coming on and talking more about the movie. She actually speaks Spanish, and was going to tell us, I was hoping she was going to be able to tell us about watching a movie without subtitles and, you know, maybe how that compares to the subbed experience. And then also she knows a lot about the war, the Civil War that's going on kind of in the background of this movie. She knows a lot about like the art of this period, and like, I won't say an expert, but, you know, definitely knows more than certainly I do. But at the last minute, I found out that she goes to bed at like 8 o'clock. So she didn't want to come on at like, it's seven, right? So, okay, yeah. Fair enough. So we were all going to watch Pan's Labyrinth. I usually ask, oh, you know, hey, X person, why did you bring this to the show? Obviously, we're not going to be able to ask that one. So I can give a little bit of background. I first saw this movie when I was probably in 9th or 10th grade. It was still kind of new then, although sort of had like a reputation as being this like cool, artsy, dark movie. Saw it like on DVD over at a friend's house. And I thought I knew this movie going in. I hardly remembered anything that actually happens in Pan's Labyrinth. What were your guys? Had you guys seen this before? Was it a first time watch, Gideon?
I saw this movie. It was crazy. While I was studying abroad in China, I saw this movie for the first time, but that was maybe about 10, 11 years ago now. Mm-hmm. So, and I'd only seen it that one time since, but yeah, similar to you, you know, I'd heard about this movie for a while. It had this kind of stature to it, so I was very keen to watch it and check it out. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I didn't remember much at all from my first time viewing.
Yeah. How about you, Neil?
Yeah, I never saw this before tonight, or when I watched it on Monday, sorry. I remember it coming out, and I remember images of, I think he's called the Pale Man. And he, you know, triggered my like body horror fight or flight instinct.
Mm-hmm.
I never this apart from that, I went into this totally blind.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's interesting. So basically, if we had to break down kind of a plot synopsis of Pan's Labyrinth, it is about, it's set in the background of, what would we say, like World War II is happening in Europe, or World War II is just about to start happening in Europe?
It's the end of World War II.
It's 44. At one point, they are reading a newspaper and the Normandy landings.
Normandy, right. Okay. Yeah, you're right. I always, in retrospect, I always kind of forget how late the United States joined World War II. Anyway, that's just me being dumb about history, I guess. But yeah, anyway, so it's about, there's a war going on in the background between like a rebel faction and a, you guys are going to have to clear this up for me. I mean, the villains in this movie are very like fascistic, but right. they're not Nazis, are they?
No, they're not Nazis, but they are fascists. Francisco right. Franco was not the OG fascist, but it was, you know, him and, Mussolini.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay. So like, I guess what I'm kind of asking is the villains in this movie are not politically necessarily connected to like the axis of evil.
Spain remained neutral.
Spain was neutral. Okay. And this, Vidal is the government of Spain. Basically, I mean, he represents the government of Spain of this time.
Yes.
Correct. Yes. Okay. Just so I'm clear on the history. Okay. That makes more sense. I wasn't quite sure what was going on there because, you know, typically when we read about World War II, we read about like five different countries and we don't. So, you know, some of the status of the other nations involved is kind of like a little shaky. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's really interesting to know. So there is a kind of World War II is going on in the background. There is this fascist regime that's taken over Spain. There's a rebel contingent in the background, but really the movie is more about Ophelia, who is this young girl who's like really into fairy tales, who has been sort of adopted by a captain of this Nazi regime as part of him getting married to her mother, and her father was a tailor but had died in the war, so she just kind of through bad luck is adopted into this into this parental situation that she doesn't really want, and things are complicated. And then the sort of the fantasy elements of the movie come in, and she's visited by a fun who says, okay, you do these three tasks for me, and you know, you're going to become a princess of the underworld. Like, you know, you used to be a princess of the underworld in another life, and we need to get you back there. And so here's all the steps you need to follow. And so there's the kind of this like realistic war thing going on in the background, and there's this fantasy element. So, you know, that's kind of how our story sets off into course. Overall, Neil, I mean, what are your thoughts? I'm so excited to hear what your thoughts on this are, because I think this is an excellent, excellent movie, and you just saw it for the first time.
Yeah, I would agree. It's very good. I was so glad that like my initial sort of thoughts about like, oh, it's a body horror movie. There are certain elements of that more than just the Pale Man, but that's not what it's about. So overall, you know, just very excited by it. The opening sequence, my very first thought actually was, the guys who made Dark Souls must have been inspired by this, because that opening like fantasy landscape that they shoot is just straight out of Dark Souls or Demon Souls or something like that. But yeah, I really like, you know, we'll get to this point, but I really don't have that many bad things to say about it. Most of them are pretty nitpicky, I think. I do think it does kind of suffer from having a child as the lead, both in terms of just like the actress's acting ability and like the decisions a child would make. But overall, you know, just great performance.
Yeah, and I would imagine that I don't mean this in any sort of way other than that it was, I thought, a really good performance, but did you love the villain in this movie as much as I did?
You know, for, you know, I'm, the joke is that I side with the bad guys in a lot of movies and games and stuff. I found the captain to be interestingly sympathetic in some ways. Like he obviously is dealing with his own traumas, not very well, but like clearly like his own childhood was pretty fucked up, and he's, you know, not necessarily enjoying his own life right now either. But no, I wasn't, you know, like, let's go Franco.
Yeah, right. Hard to root for, but I thought an interesting and a compelling villain, and he has a lot of screen time, and I enjoyed like every minute that villain's on screen. He's just love to hate him.
Yeah. Just one interesting historical note is that so the captain is the leader of you know, a troop of like military police, or I'm not entirely sure if he's police or army, but you know, they're combating anti-government rebels who are ostensibly communist, because like it's a carryover from the Civil War, but I'm sure like the movie, I think, generally just portrays them more as just like anti-fascist. But and they're the sympathetic good guys, but historically they lose. Like Franco ruled Spain until he died in like the 70s. It's like him and Pol Pot just totally got away with it.
Oh, see, I didn't know any of that. Okay, so that's all interesting. Yeah, I thought he was just very well, I don't say well written, but they did a lot of things to like establish his villainous and like establish his motives and kind of establish his character. Like, he's like super clean, and he's like shaving every night to the same music, and he's like very methodical and cold. Like, even like one of the very first like really violent things we see in the movie is him catch the farmer and his son, and he bashes that guy's face in with a bottle, which is a brutal scene, but even the way he does it is very emotionless and just like but like almost like RoboCop would do it or something.
Yeah, very exacting.
Yeah, the actor is very good at telling you a lot about that character just through his like actions and his motions. And I think of like the hillside battle where he's like going up the hill and coming out from behind the trees, and he's very methodically like bah, bah. I mean, he's not doing all these like crazy like dives and rolls like an action movie hero. I mean, he's like the most cold, calculating. Just those officer guns, by the way, just so sweet. Like I don't really know how to describe them, but they have like the little rounded handle on them, and then they just kept the tiny neck on the gun. Really cool looking. And it kind of reminds me of like the officer guns in Star Wars. You know what I'm talking about? Mm-hmm. Anyway.
They look sick. Yeah.
So Gideon, you were watching this for the first time in a long time. How did it strike you?
Yeah. I mean, that is one of the few things I remembered was some of the violence really stuck in my head. Like that farmer kid getting his face like flattened. And yeah, upon revisiting it, I mean, this is a really well-crafted dark fantasy movie. I definitely think it's almost like a must-watch if you're just trying to kind of broaden your horizons. For it being almost 20 years old now, I think it really holds up, especially stuff like The Pale Man and The Fawn. Like the sets Neil was talking about. Lots of the performances I thought were really strong. I also agree with Neil. I don't think there's much bad I could really say about it. Maybe it might drag here or there for a little bit with certain pacing elements, but overall I had a lot of fun revisiting this, and I think it really holds up.
Now, are you like me where when I was thinking back on this movie from watching it in like ninth grade or whatever, I was thinking about mostly the fantasy stuff and then the violent stuff. And I didn't remember all the plotting with the rebel faction within the camp. I didn't remember that like Mercedes was like a double agent. I didn't remember that like the doctor was in on it. I didn't remember the stutterer. I didn't remember any of that stuff. I just remembered the Pale Man and the Fawn and kind of that sort of stuff.
I didn't even remember like the frog for fantastical stuff. I totally agree. The main things that just stick in your head, obviously the crazy character design with the Fawn, and even the way the maze or the labyrinth itself looked and everything.
I would agree with you. Definitely, like even then, it's kind of stuck out to me as very indicative of Del Toro, like as a filmmaker. Like I feel like you can tell a lot about him as a person through this movie, even though like it's so fantastical and so separated to be like considered autobiographical in a way. And it's like Del Toro was not a child in the era of World War II or anything like that. He grew up in Mexico and things like that, but was obviously fascinated with fairy tales. But the characters that are in this movie that are also in The Shape of Water kind of give it away in terms of like, oh, this is, Del Toro obviously feels a certain way about fascism and fascistic characters, because the villain in this and the villain in The Shape of Water are almost identical. Just like the lead actress in The Shape of Water looks like the adult version of the girl from this movie. I mean, he has like very strong archetype roles that he fills through, and you can kind of get more of a sense of him as a person by comparing all those different elements of the movie. And then of course like the fantasy stuff, which he is kind of I would say most well known for. I have such a respect for him as a filmmaker, because he's capable of making something like this that is like ostensibly an Oscar winning art, like a more art house movie, and then he's capable of making Pacific Rim.
Right. Mm-hmm. And even it's cool too, because you almost think of it going in like, okay, it's going to be almost like a darker Alice in Wonderland type thing, which it definitely is and has plenty of that. But it, you know, even though we didn't really remember too much of the, let's say, current day or set story that's going on with the warring factions and everything, it's still really strong. Like all the characters and what's happening and the stakes and even like little details of her like hiding the knife, or the main bad guy, the captain. Like I remember when he picked up the chalk, like at one point, it like kind of scrawls on his desk a little bit near the end. So just lots of cool little details that I feel like really enhance the storytelling. And even like, again, to touch on the violence, like you really sit with it for some of the scenes in this movie, like when he's stitching himself back up or, you know, I feel like there was some other one that stood out, but obviously the farmer's getting beaten and everything, like it holds on that and you really experience it for a minute.
Yeah. Neil, what was your reaction to the pale man eating the fairies?
That wasn't so bad for me. I mean, that does actually bring up, though, I think one of my biggest complaints about the movie.
Okay.
I think the pale man scene is great. The lead up to him becoming animated, though, is very much, though, to me, like, badly written. In the sense, like, okay, oh man, we made this cool effect, and now we need to have a reason to use it. So, like, the premise is she has to get into his home and steal something, steal his dagger, and she's told explicitly, don't eat the food. She's not told why, but she's told not to eat the food. And she winds up eating two grapes, and that's what causes him to activate. She triggered the boss fight.
Right.
And while I was watching, I was like, okay, so she's going to eat the food because she's a dumb kid. And I just thought, like, this could have been solved with, like, a 20-second scene of her, like, rationing is on, and I haven't been able to eat my favorite food, grapes, in years. Or, in her previous adventure where she got the key that unlocks the box that the knife is in, she's sent to bed without dinner.
Yeah.
But that happened, like, 2 or 3 nights ago. Because... So it was just like, okay, so she's just gonna eat the food because she's a dumb kid, and that to me was just disappointing.
Yeah, you're right. I didn't make the connection between like the going to bed without dinner and the scene where, you know, she, I don't want to say gluttonously takes it, but she takes it without thinking. But yeah, you're right. Those things could have been connected and made that scene stronger. I think I agree with you, but more from a perspective of like even the framing. All through the pale man scene is like that thing's coming alive. There's no doubt, because even when she's doing something that doesn't really involve the pale man, it's in the background of every shot. Like you're waiting for it to come alive. It's like Chekhov's monster. Like they're not going to spend that much money on that creature design and then not use it to chase her down the hallway. And at no point do you ever like. I was tense in that scene, but I didn't really feel like Ophelia was going to die. You know what I mean? I was like, this is. Or 45 minutes into the movie, Ophelia is not going to get eaten by the pale man, right?
Yeah.
I can't think of many more visually iconic monster designs from this era than the pale man. I mean, you do this to anybody who's like a movie fan, and everybody knows what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's to me, like it's both like the pale man and the fawn. Like the combination of like the practical costume effects, and then they used like CGI to like remove the fawn's human legs so that he could have the goat appearance. But like most of it's just a practical effect, and it's fantastic. The Pale Man is also an amazing, mostly practical effect with some CGI elements. Mostly again just like green screen removal. And it works beautifully. It's an amazing effect. But that also like kind of makes, again, child actor their performance worse, because it's not like you can say, oh, like one of the issues with like a lot of early CGI movies, or like even with, we were talking a little bit about Star Wars earlier, with the prequel trilogy, where it was just all CGI and the actors just had to interact with like a ball on a stick and they don't really know what they're looking at. She doesn't have that excuse. Like, she's got the meat and potatoes of that effect in front of her, and she's acting like it isn't there almost.
Mm-hmm. No, you're right. In that it's a completely wonderful effect. And there's something, I mean, you can't really say this about the Pale Man, because it's just like a monster closet monster, but there's something appealing about the character of the Fawn to me in this movie. I don't know if you guys get that same sense, but there's something like, I would like watch a, like, I don't want this because it would ruin the mystique, but I would like watch a whole movie just about the Fawn. He's just so cool. It's just everything about that character. That is just a complete stroke of genius. And he's only on screen for sub 10 minutes in this whole runtime. And he like steals the show. Like, he's one of the things that people really remember about this movie. It's just such an iconic visual. I feel like we could talk forever about the visuals. This is a beautiful movie. Even in when like none of the fantasy stuff is going on, it's bathed in this like nice amber kind of lighting, this like almost nostalgic kind of warm sunbathed kind of lighting. And then everything, I mean, this ties into like Ophelia's thing about being like born of the moon, but then all the nighttime stuff is like moonlit and nice and very cool temperature wise and yeah, it's just a wonderfully shot, wonderful movie to look at, just ultra gorgeous. I don't know if you guys have any strong feelings on that.
Yeah. I mean, I would totally agree with just the visuals on the whole, being very striking, obviously with all the fantasy elements, but the cool architecture, but even just like the farm that they're at is cool and interesting to look at, and like the captain's quarters, or you know, compared to like what the rebels are living in, that like cave or whatever they're at. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Neil?
Yeah, I agree. Like, I was actually very much enamored by the mill. I was like, man, that would be a cool like summer retreat if you took out all the fascists.
Yeah.
But yeah, like great location scouting, I'd say. They really did a lot with the forests. And yeah, I think it's gorgeous. I think like one of the things that they probably did was like the reason the Fawn and the Pale Man are on screen so little is because it is like such a great effect. And I think they did, but it was probably very expensive to make those things. So I'm betting that they had
this. It's just a great example of like a special effects feature made the right way.
Yeah. But like, I'm sure they had to cut corners in other places, but like you definitely don't see where they cut corners.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wonder, I'm kind of curious what the budget of this movie is. I mean, I know it's a Mexican made movie, so there's no way it was as expensive to make as if they were using Hollywood actors and Hollywood workers and effects and things like that. But I would imagine it was kind of a middling budget on the movie because they don't have that many locations. It's really just the fantasy sets. And then, you know, it's like the mill, and then they shoot out in the woods a little bit, and then they've got some expensive like creature designs, but I don't think it could have been all that expensive to make comparatively.
It was made for about 19 million US.
Mm-hmm. At least at the time. Yeah. So that's like a little bit more than it would cost to make like a Woody Allen movie. So that's like almost nothing. That's pretty amazing. Got other things, other performances we want to call out in this movie. I think the actress who plays Mercedes is very good. I had forgotten how central of a role that character was.
Mm-hmm.
She's very good, and I feel like the doctor is very compelling mm-hmm. as well. How about you guys?
Trying to think if there was any other real standout ones. I did like the mom. Just how mm-hmm. she kind of showcased how compassionate she was and kind of where the lead actress got that compassion from herself. You know, I thought that was nice. You know, where, like, you know, she's surrounded by all these horrifying things, you know, the horrifying monsters and the main villain and everything like that. You know, her mom is still there to comfort her while she's around.
I had a totally different read on the mom. I mean, I think she's, like, kind of naive is, I think, is a kind way of putting it. Like, you know, I think so one other complaint I had about this movie was it falls into one of those tropes that I hate where I don't understand why the couple is together in the first place. So like the captain's motivation is he just wants a son. Like, this woman is a baby factory to him. So I get it from his end. From hers, I think it's a little more ambiguous, probably just like, you know, he brings home a steady paycheck.
Right.
You know, but it's never like explicitly said. But,
yeah,
you know, at what point, I guess I'm just kind of challenging here, but at every point, every major point of conflict between Ophelia and the captain, I think she is on the captain's side, not Ophelia's.
Yeah, that's true. She definitely seems like she's kind of placating to him and just trying to appease him. And I think even to your point of, like, why are they together? I think just with where she's at in her pregnancy and everything, she just seems so concerned and just trying to keep, like, a safe, stable roof over her two kids, or soon-to-be two kids' heads.
Right, that's kind of how I read that as well. Like, her motivation is that the country that she's living in is at war, and if it means protecting she just saw a golden opportunity to protect her incoming baby and the child she already has. So, I mean, that's like a lot of what Ophelia talks, or not Ophelia, the mother talks about later in the movie when she's like, oh, you know, it's a cruel world and things aren't going to work out like the fairy tale you've worked up in your head. I mean, it clearly didn't for her.
I was confused when they were talking at the dinner table and she was like explaining, they asked like how they met and she said they had met again, like she was at the shop or something. I just wasn't really sure like how exactly they met with that story that she told there.
Yeah, ultimately, I don't think it's like uber important, right? Like, all you need to know is that the husband and the father died as a result of the war. Or is that explicitly? No, they say he was killed in the war.
Yeah.
And you know, so she's like forced to take up with probably the people who fucking killed her.
Yeah.
Probably. I mean, not directly, but still. I mean, you know, what a horrible thing. Yeah, I mean, it's just there's a million threads to pull out with this movie, but I'm struggling to find conversation topics really about it because it is so strong. I mean, it kind of brings me back to the whole like Frost Nixon thing. It's like, what do we talk about when we're all like, yeah, the movie ripped, right? It's like, I'm kind of ready to just like give stars on this movie. Like, I don't know how you guys feel about it. Neil, did you have any other nitpicks you wanted to throw in here before we kind of?
Yeah, I've got one more.
Yeah, let's hear it.
So, late in the movie, it's revealed that Mercedes is working with the anti-government rebels.
Yeah.
And the captain takes her to the torture chamber, and he's going to interrogate her, but she manages to break free, and she cuts his mouth open, triggering my body horror impulses, and then later he sews his mouth back together, which was even worse. But I don't understand why she didn't just kill him
for real,
because he would like raise the alarm and get like it's like, again, it was like a plot convenience of we need her to be chased so that, you know, we can kill off a group of the fascist soldiers so that the rebels have a numerical advantage. But I don't know why she just didn't kill
him. Right. I think it's also important for the plot because, and again, I'm not excusing it, but I'm saying that, like, one of the things, letting Vidal live eventually leads to, like, there's no other character in this movie that it would make sense for to shoot Ophelia.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Like, nobody else is, like, that evil, but Vidal is, so we gotta keep him alive so he can just, like, pop, 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 take her down. Which is surprising. Like,
yeah.
I guess I didn't, you know, that wasn't one of the mental images that I remembered about this movie, was that the girl mm-hmm. dies at the end. Yeah. But I was kind of surprised. I was like, okay, because rarely do bad things happen to kids
yeah.
in movies, and they just straight up, like, pop, 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 and that's fucking it. She's just, like, bleeding out there on the ground. It's, like, an incredibly ballsy move. Even though there's kind of a happily ever after, like, a very macabre happily ever after, and I love the ending of this movie. It was very shocking that they had the balls to, like, just kill the kid on screen.
And they show you, too, at the beginning yeah. of the movie, like, with that same shot. But, mm-hmm. you know, you think they might be talking about when she had died in her previous life or whatever.
Right.
Yeah. I have one other thing I thought was just kind of funny. Near the end of the movie, when Mercedes is escaping with Ophelia, and she's like, oh, I thought I heard something or whatever. And she's like, no, it must be nothing. And then, like, obviously it's for a dramatic effect, but she, like, turns her umbrella and it's like Vidal, and the entire force is, like, right there, like, all, like, 15, 20 men yeah. remaining. And that was just funny. It's like, yeah, you didn't hear that? Like, I thought
the entire Spanish armada is
yeah.
silently yeah. right there.
Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition.
Yeah, for
yeah. Yeah, if they they straight up stealth mode that.
Before we get to stars, I do have a question for you guys.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
In the context of the movie,
mm-hmm.
do you think that the supernatural elements are real, or is it a delusion on Ophelia's part?
Well, I think it's a delusion on Ophelia's part, because at the end we're explicitly shown through Vidal's eyes that the Fawn doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, I don't know. Ultimately, I don't think it's that important. But at least that's the read I think that the filmmaker wanted me to take away, but I'm certainly open to different interpretations.
I want to agree with Sam, but, like, then there's other stuff that almost makes you believe different, like when the mom throws the mandrake root in the fire and then, like, almost immediately, like, goes into labor or whatever, is, like, gonna die from the childbirth. But, and it's like, you know, when Vidal doesn't see the Fawn, is it like, okay, is it because it's not real, or it's because that's the type of person he is?
Right, Vidal is not pure of heart enough to see the Fawn.
Yeah. So, it's cool either way, but I guess for me, I would think it is delusions, for sure. So,
our moral compass here is, like, would Goku be able to see the Fawn? I think Goku would be able to see the Fawn, oh, yeah. personally.
He'd dap it up for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. This is a tangent. This is a question I always pose to people about Dragon Ball Z. Do we think Goku can read?
Ooh. I guess I don't remember him picking up a book or anything.
Mm-hmm.
Or driving any vehicles. I don't know.
He takes the driver's test with Piccolo in Dragon Ball Z.
Oh, yeah, okay. there is a side episode where they do take their driver's test, but I still don't think that proves that Goku can read.
It'd be really awesome if he couldn't read and he still did all that. <He's> like, I kind of want to believe he can't read.
He's like the Forrest Gump of anime.
There's like one thing he's not good at.
I think he can read simply because he goes to restaurants and is able to order.
Well, what if they have pictures on the menu then, Neil?
Not always.
That's true.
It'd be like me ordering in Spanish. Me have ham. Me have one ham to eat, please.
Oh my god. That's awesome.
Oh man. Yeah, anyway. This is exactly the kind of fantasy movie that I'm into. Like, it has to be grounded in some sort of reality. And I think they do a wonderful job here of like grounding it in events and characters and feelings and emotions that you can totally relate to as a person. And then the fantasy world that they do show you is a very unique fantasy world. I mean, it feels like it came straight out of Guillermo del Toro's mind. And in many ways, it feels inspired by like Mexican mythology, and it feels inspired by like classic European fairy tales. Just wonderful, wonderful stuff. I mean, like, this is the kind of movie that I always want to see, which is like well-paced, interesting concepts and things going on. And I love movies that have like, you know, on the surface level are entertaining to watch and you like the characters and you enjoy watching it. And then there's this deeper level where there's like other stuff to think about too. And there's a million visual things in this movie that mean two things. Like when they first show the drawing of the Pale Man in the in Ophelia's book, it has its like it's like very straight up and down, but then its arms are like go around like that, and it's clearly supposed to look like a womb, like the medical diagram you see of like a woman's womb, and that like that one visual is there for 2 seconds, and it has a million different like thematic implications about the story and everything. It's just incredible on a million different levels, and I still think that like Guillermo del Toro is like, if not the best living director, like right up there with the top 3 or 4 in my mind. So this is a 5-star movie for me. I have like no bones about giving this a 5-star. Like this movie fucking kicks ass.
Nice. Damn. Cool. For me, I really liked it. I liked revisiting it. I'm going to give it a 4 personally. I don't think for whatever reason it doesn't like click with me as hard as it might with other people. I feel like there's some people they see this movie and it's like totally life-changing. It just mm-hmm. like makes them think about movies and art differently. And I do think it's totally worth revisiting, totally a must watch. But yeah, just not a personal favorite of mine, I guess. But really good, and not a lot I can really complain about with this movie.
To me, dude, that is completely the difference between a 4 and a 5. Is like a 4 is like, I find it very hard to fault this movie, but I do not personally connect to it in like a spiritual level, right? Which is like what makes a movie a 5, right? Mm-hmm. All right, Neil, how about you?
Yeah, I'm with Gid. It's a 4. So yeah, 100% worth watching. Probably worth a rewatch in the nearest future, just to see if there's stuff that I missed or reevaluate certain thoughts. But yeah, I'm not sure it like speaks to me directly, mm-hmm. but it's still just like a very strong performance all around. Any complaints I had about it are generally just pretty nitpicky, like mm-hmm. efficiency of script, but art doesn't always have to be efficient.
Yeah, and I feel it's like fairly well paced, and it's like kind of a breezy watch, even though it's kind of a heavy subject matter. There's just something like, I don't want to say light and enjoyable, that's not the right word, but it's like there is something sort of like fairy tale esque about it that I don't know. To me, it's just like one of those magic movies, and I could see like not recommending it to people who don't want to do subtitles or like can't handle the violence, but I think if you're like a movie fan, like watching Pan's Labyrinth is like totally a must.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right, well, guys, I appreciate you guys coming on. I think we'll have to talk in the chat about what we want to do about next week. I'm more than willing to take the L on this one and chalk this up as a my pick, and we can go on to whoever's next. We can decide what we want to do. So I'll talk to you guys next week.
Sounds good.
Thanks for coming on, guys.
Bye, guys.
Have a good one.